the matter of Kornbluth versus Westover. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Michael Hyman. Your plaintiff, Dr. Joseph, is out of Kornbluth.
May it please the court. My name is William Martin from Martin, Dunn & Martin. I represent the respondents, Thomas and Betsy.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Hyman, please go ahead.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Honorable Justices. May it please the Court. My clients in this case are grateful for petition for certification having been granted. We know their grounds that are well stated for certification. In this particular case, not only is there a clear need for the dispositions below and the error below, clear need for sorting out some law that unfortunately has been distorted, but there's a grievous need here for justice in this particular case. When the, if I may, just to put this very, and my comments will be brief because we're dealing here solely and exclusively with relief from disposition on two orders that started below, one in an interlocutory order, and the second an order, a final order disposition for summary judgment, two orders, and I'll get to those quickly. But if I may, when the curtain on this unfortunate opera rose 9/9/2013, 6 years ago, I guess practicing for me over half a century, I could say unfortunately our system runs on the back of a tortoise. But when this happened, this was the simple setting of this, and there's nothing controversial. This may just help put this immediately in perspective. I'll show it to counsel here. This is merely the relationship between the plaintiff and the defendants in this particular case. Very, very simple. They have houses with opposing backyards. The Westovers, defendants in the case, front their house on Harrogate. Plaintiffs, Kornbluth, front on St. Vincent. They have backyards that abut but with no firm fencing between them. Approximately 100 feet in width, this backyard, and this is open space. The home of the Kornbluths, fronting on St. Vincent, is really designed to live in the back because it has a considerable amount of glass in the back, a large deck, and a step down into a cultivated area here. Within the plaintiff's backyard, they're 30 feet deep into that yard. They had a totally dense visual privacy screen of full-grown bamboo and some other deciduous trees. That's where this started. On September 9, 2013, at 9 o'clock at night, there's a knock on the door. And I must say, too, that the relationship between the plaintiff and the defendants in this case is solely polite. There is no socialization between the families to speak of.
Mr. Hyman, could I interrupt your opening?
Yes.
We're familiar with the factual background of the case. Tell us how the APDIV got it wrong.
I'm sorry?
Tell us what's wrong with the appellate division decision.
Oh, okay,
and what relief you're entitled to.
We're dealing here with two orders. After discovery, the case is set for trial. Situation that brings to presence the need for correction. The case was trial listed for October 26 before Judge Maloney, Trial Court, Camden County. Third on the list, might have been reached, might not have been list. Behind the third, there's the fourth and the fifth trial list. Nothing peremptory about this trial listing. Plaintiffs came in late in the morning after apparently disposition of the first ones. We meet with a court, and at that point, I'm somewhat personally discomforted because my associate counsel, my second chair in this matter, been with this case intimately from the very beginning, was not there. living in Chester County, Pennsylvania, and commuting wasn't there. Meet with the court shortly. Some of the factual issues to discuss. Judge Maloney's practice was never, notwithstanding a trial listing, never pull a jury on a Monday, pull them on a Tuesday. There's a minute or so break. I finally get my associate on the phone and learn she's feverishly in bed with the flu. Not going to be available certainly for the early part of it, and perhaps even the entire week. Go back and see the court. I'm there with, at that time, Stacy Cohen, who was the sole counsel of record for the defendants. He said, well, I'll see you tomorrow. We're going to pull the jury. I said, well, I'm not sure we can proceed because I can't try this case without my second chair. And I might say, I've learned, as long as I've been doing this over half a century, I've learned I can't watch, think, feel, assess in my own head in trial where there's a detailed record, a complex record, without the assistance of a second chair and taking for me to be taking notes at the same time and thinking in terms of supporting documentation. Second chair vital.
Mr. Heine,
we leave.
Again, I'm sorry to interrupt.
But
this is an abuse of discretion standard for the issue that you're raising, correct?
Yes.
So tell us succinctly why it was an abuse of discretion, and then please move on to the second issue.
Sure. The court dismissed the action, invited application for sanctions, and in a congruent motion carried out, put on record the dismissal. There's no issue in the record. I documented of record the fact that why my second chair was unavailable. I came in the next morning with certificate. All that's there.
An abuse of discretion.
Okay. The abuse of discretion is the court saying, I've never heard of, you're the designated counsel. I've never heard of a case not being moving forward because of lack of supporting second chair counsel. Whether he used the word second chair, I'm not sure.
Did you just use it a few minutes ago? Got it from you. You said it was your second chair to us. I suspect Judge Maloney got that. You said you don't know why he used the word second chair. We probably got it from you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, what I'm saying is I used the term second chair when the judge said I've never heard of a case not proceeding forward with the absence of, may have said supporting counsel. This goes back a few years, I don't remember. But this is the concept, the expression second chair was the comment that I made. And clearly that's, as we understand the label, that's what it was. The abuse of discretion is that it just, we're dealing here with 1:2-4 sanction where without just excuse or failure to give reasonable attention to a matter, there's a sanction issued. And clearly, seems to me, no court can find as a matter of law that there is an unexplainable right of the trial court to grant a short extension, whatever necessary, move on to the list. There was no peremptory positions on this case.
Mr. Heine, there are no peremptory lists in civil. The civil conference, civil presiding judges have determined that intent. There are no peremptory listings in the civil division in this state. The Conference of Civil Presiding Judges has determined that that's not appropriate because it affects other counties. How many times have your case been listed before that day?
How many cases that day?
How many times had your case been listed before that day?
I think it was listed one time previously, but then adjourned by the court.
Just one time?
Just one time, yes. And so I think the clear abuse of discretion is, and incidentally too, no challenge whatsoever of record in the record before this court or before the appellate division or indeed before the trial court that disputed what in fact the justification was given for the inability of a plaintiff to proceed, pull a jury, and do everything necessary for the trial.
You were designated trial counsel, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I was designated. There's no question about it.
The court offered some assistance with regard to the presentation of the evidence through the...
Yeah, but that was not a suggestion that was meaningful. When a lawyer in a complex record has to deal with technical presentation in a courtroom, as we did in this case, not only a considerable amount of photographs, but identification of parts of depositions for purposes of presentation, direct proofs, and cross-examination, the fact that somebody can come in and pull a switch on a lever and something goes up on the screen is not in any way assisting trial counsel. This was an intimate relationship between an intimate relationship of the preparation and presentation and effective management of the proofs and the record in this particular case. Absolutely essential, and none of it disputed. Not a bit of it disputed.
We have your position on this. Can you move
okay,
on to the second
Okay, thank
issue?
You. Thank you. The case was listed for trial with a newly appointed judge in the matter who, on a motion for summary judgment, dismissed it because the on the motion grounded on the theory that there should have been proofs resulting from the trespass of diminution of value. The proofs that were developed in this particular case treated the peculiar value of the lost of the damage to the property. And I might say, off record, no dispute whatsoever to the following information that underscores the error in the trial court below and consequently in the appellate division. One, note, and again, these are the things actually no dispute. There was venal intent. There was a contractor of the adjoining property owner to go trespass into the plaintiff's property. There was no issue about the knowledge of the defendant that the property he was on and destroyed the bamboo was not his property. It was the property of the plaintiffs. No dispute of the fact that he requested authority and the authority was denied explicitly. No dispute that the subject matter of the full-grown bamboo and deciduous trees provided visual privacy that was indispensable to the enjoyment of by the owners of their property. Absolutely undisputed that it provided total visual privacy. No dispute to the fact that it was important to them. Sections of the deposition are included in the petition. You've seen the comments of Dr. Kornbluth and Mrs. Kornbluth and how they felt about this intrusion and what it did to their enjoyment of their property. No dispute about that. No dispute whatsoever as to what the cost would be for the remediation of the loss. Whatsoever, there was expert testimony, not an expert for any cause whatsoever in the defendant's case. Indeed, on our motion for summary judgment, a counterclaim was dismissed, and defendants were criticized by Judge Cassell for not having any expert supporting testimony. No dispute whatsoever that there was a single fair remedy using the standards that are applied in the thorough review of all this law by Judge Sabatino in his opinion, or in the Serpico decision upon which he relied, or the decisions out of state dealing with peculiar value is the termination that's used. I think perhaps a different label for that could be used, maybe idiosyncratic value or personal value, but there's no question what's meant by special value. The fact that the items themselves the element itself, the total visual screen was lost. No question whatsoever that the facts that were under review meaningfully in the Mosteller decision, which was absolutely guidance and useful, happened to have been, in that case, shade. We're dealing with a visual function, human function, as opposed to privacy. Also, a visual function. We're not dealing here with anything that's ephemeral and can't be understood and appreciated. We're dealing with physical subjects on the property, none there. And no question whatsoever that the full-grown screen provided privacy. All of the elements, every single one of the dispositive elements that the Mosteller decision indicated were meaningful in an analysis of what the appropriate remedy were present in this case and fully supported 100%. In addition to that,
Mr. Heine, was there any evidence presented on behalf of your clients as to what it would cost to replace the bamboo?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, we had
by what way?
Oh yeah, but there was testimony, deposition, a report by. Pagankoff, why am I missing his first name, licensed landscape architect.
Did that person come in and testify at the trial?
Oh, he didn't have
summary judgment.
His deposition was taken. There was no testimony. We're not dealing here with trial, Justice. We're dealing here with
summary judgment.
With a record on the motion. And absolutely that expert opinion was there. His deposition was taken. All of that was before Judge Rodriguez, and before the, you know, as part of the record.
What was the restoration value?
What was the,
according
it changed over, initially it started in the area of approximately $20,000. It then increased because of the passage of time and weed growth and other things to $25,000. Now with additional time on the remedy that we seek here, necessary fairness, there ought to be some time so that those proofs can be just essentially brought up to date, and there's clear authority for that.
Is it accurate from my review of the record that a lot of the, some of the bamboo was on the defendant's property?
No proof of that, allegation of that. They tried to prove that. We moved for summary judgment on the grounds that they asserted that, this bamboo was invading their property. Incidentally, in this bamboo soup, I've learned there's different kinds of bamboo. Some of it moves, some of it's aggressive, some of it's not. You know, it has an interesting reputation. Nevertheless, no proofs by the defendant, or maybe some comment. There was comment in their deposition, but no documented proofs by any supporting expert of
intrusion
on their property.
It was summary judgment. And the deposition, did the defendants say it was encroaching on their property, and by how much?
No. Defendants? No. Absolutely not.
Never
mentioned the fact that there was bamboo in their property. They thought they had a right. I mean, came in.
So they did mention that the bamboo had gone onto their property.
Well, they mentioned there was a mention of that, but that's easily controlled because they made no effort in the record, absolutely no effort whatsoever, to dispose and contain the bamboo that was properly on our client's property and enjoyed legitimately and fairly as a matter of law.
Well, what about the bamboo on their property?
They did nothing. They made no effort whatsoever to control it.
Are they required to do that when it's encroaching on their property from your client's property?
No. If there is a the law, clearly as I understand it, is if there's an intrusion by growth from one property on the next, the property that intrudes upon has a right to dispose of it. Can't go on the adjoining property. You cut it
down. Can they charge the encroacher for the cost of removing it?
I think not.
Because you're arguing fundamental fairness to us. I'm just wondering if you have to continue to remove the encroaching, whatever it is, if that should be the responsibility of the party who has the encroaching.
Justice, that goes beyond what's before this court on the record that's actionable here. I mean, the whole distraction on the motion, the summary judgment motion before the court below.
Not on your diminution of value claim, perhaps on the replacement cost claim, but not on diminution of value.
Well, but we don't get to the diminution on the facts of this case that are operative, well settled, Mosteller's, the Sabatino opinion, Huber case. We are dealing exclusively on the operative facts in this record to special restorative cost. There is nothing in here that pushes this away from that remedy. Incidentally, a very important line that appears in the Mosteller decision and repeated and nothing new from Judge Sabatino there is that each of these tests, referring Judge Sabatino was to the two tests, the possible tests of diminution of value or specialized care, he says, each of these tests has a, I'm quoting, has a wide sphere of application in the court selection. Is of one test or the other is basically an assessment of which is more likely to afford full and reasonable compensation. Not disputed. There is no contrary information. And incidentally, let me go back, please, to Justice Sinovito's comment about, you know, whether or not what the obligations were to the other side. There again, and I thought I mentioned, there was a counterclaim they brought for intrusion and all those so-called related assessed damages. On motion, it was vacated, and Judge Cassell said, "I don't trust you." I said, and I've quoted his comment in the record in a footnote in our moving brief. I find it unfathomable that you don't have an expert to support your position. Counsel came in with a whole bunch of stuff she pulled off the internet to make herself an expert. So the only thing that was before the trial court below, the only thing before the appellate division below, the only thing factually of record before this court respectfully, is what was done On the motion simply to deny the plaintiffs their alternative remedy, fully supported in the record, fully supported, without even any counter arguments, fully supported on the record that they were entitled to because of the special attachment they had between this existing physical visual barrier, which gave them privacy, and their entitlement for that special value and attachment to relief. Thank you. Oh, here, certainly. That's my opening, privileged opening comment.
I only have one question.
Sure.
Did your clients actually expend money to replace the bamboo that was removed?
They haven't done it yet, and because with the...
That's all I wanted to know.
Well, but it's important to know that it's serious, and it's not neglect, because the litigation costs of this thing have been substantial. Substantial, again, not before this court, but actual out-of-pocket costs. The conditions there have changed. We're dealing here, they couldn't do it because now we've got litigation ongoing as to whether or not what they intend to do is legitimate, and the court has to come to a final decision about that before they spend the money that was proposed in the landscaping plan of their professional architect, before they spend that money and do that to know that they're safe in doing it. Because then we're right back into the same situation. Mm-hmm. So they're compelled to wait for a disposition. Thank
Anyone
you.
Have any questions?
No. Thank you, Mr. Heine.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Martin.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Ravner, Justice of this court, I represent Thomas and Betsy Westover. The appellate division did not err in this matter on the two orders that they reviewed. One was the order below, which was the denial of the motion to adjourn. The second order was that the denial of the motion for reconsideration. The appellate division used an abuse of discretion standard on both, and properly did so based upon the notice of appeal and the transcripts that were provided. I submit to you that that is the standard that Your Honor should have when reviewing this same record, because what took place below was the notice of appeal only appealed the reconsideration order, did not address the summary judgment order, which was April 28, 2017. It only dealt with the reconsideration motion. The order that was discussed as abuse of discretion by plaintiff's counsel, appellant, dealing with the denial of the motion to adjourn the trial. That wasn't appealed, but since there was a transcript of that, the appellate division was indulgent and addressed that. First of all, dealing with that motion and that order, if the court needs argument on that.
I'll ask you to please be succinct on that point of the appeal and move on to the next issue.
I intend to, Your Honor. It's my understanding that the petition was based upon the other issue in the case, not about, on that, but I understand you take the entire appeal. The abuse of discretion issue, the trial court has discretion to deny a request for adjournment. This was the second adjournment, second trial listing. It was third on the list. The first two trials, they said. The record is clear because Judge Maloney put it on the record, and there was argument at counsel. There was a voir dire discussion on the Monday, the 26th. They went over the voir dire. It's a Rule 183 discussion. They were prepared to pick a jury the next day. Plaintiff's counsel indicated that his second chair wasn't able to appear because she had gotten sick. There were motions in limine that were reviewed by Judge Maloney. He was prepared to rule on them. The next morning when they arrived, plaintiff's counsel refused to proceed. The trial judge addressed the motion. He gave all the reasons. He had a second chair that was ill. His secretary was going to do the presentation was ill. And the judge said, I'm not inclined to grant this because you're designated trial counsel. We can deal with the motions in limine. We can pick a jury. We can accommodate you with IT. And even counsel suggested they wait till Monday to bring the jury back. Plaintiff's counsel outright refused to proceed. And he told the judge, if you're going to dismiss my case, dismiss my case. Judge Maloney handled it very well, with restraint, He did not dismiss the case with prejudice, which he could have done in light of the direct refusal by plaintiff to appear and go forward with the case. Instead, he dismissed it without prejudice. The case was reinstated. There was a cross motion. They asked for fees, and that was granted. That's not even addressed by the appellate division because it wasn't appealed. There was no transcript. There was an oral argument December 4th. So I know I've been more than succinct on that point, but the point is there was no abuse of discretion. There was judicial restraint. It was appropriate, especially where the court is the one that runs the courthouse and the courtroom and decides whether or not to move a trial or not, addressed the issues and found it wasn't a reason. Plaintiff's counsel has no basis to refuse to proceed without a sanction being assessed. And it was
Let's go on to the next issue.
Thank you, Judge. Your Honor, with regard to the appellate division's decision affirming the reconsideration order, they did so on abuse of discretion. The trial judge had before it a motion for reconsideration. The standard is well settled. It's palpably unreasonable decision, if that was her decision, was palpably unreasonable. The appellate division set forth the standard and said there has to be manifest injustice or an abuse of discretion. And that didn't take place here. The court went on to discuss the issues of Mosteller and Huber, but there was no abuse of discretion or manifest injustice. Even if this court disagreed with that interpretation, they don't find that the trial judge did not abuse his discretion by applying Mosteller based upon the facts of this case.
Well, how about the fact that our case law in this area goes back to 1892 and forward, and the court stated back then that where a party proves that another has trespassed on his land, he's entitled to a nominal damages even if there is no proof of injury or damages to the land.
Your Honor, that is the general rule of trespass, which is if you trespass on land, that there can be nominal damages. However, with regard to trees and shrubberies or ornamental shrubberies, the law is slightly different, and that was where the Huber case decided that, and Mosteller addressed that as well. They're directly on point. And the reason for that is that trees and ornamental shrubberies don't have, according to the courts and the case law, they're not a commodity, unless, of course, it's the business of raising trees for commercial sale. That's not this case, it's residential. They're not a separate commodity. They're difficult to evaluate. They become inherently valuable to the real estate and become part of the real estate. So allowing a restoration cost as compared to diminution of market value is not the appropriate remedy. And that's how the case
But neither of those things need to be shown in order to get damages for trespass, period.
Well,
I mean, then it's up to the jury to decide whether there is a loss or not a loss or how much of a loss that there is.
Not in the context, Your Honor, of of trees and ornamental shrubberies when they deal with realty, because the difference, the general trespass rule, such as contractors and case laws like the Volpe case cited in the appellate division and the Mosteller case, that deals with another type of setting. It's not dealing with an inherently value to the property. And that's why the case law differs. The ALR article cited by Mosteller and the appellate division in our papers deals specifically with how these cases are dealt with. It's measure of damages for injury to and destruction of shade and ornamental trees or shrubberies. It's ALR 95, ALR 3rd, section 508, section 2. That deals with how these specific types of claims are addressed throughout the country. And the prevailing view when you're dealing with ornamental shrubberies or trees is that the primary available element of damages is diminution of the market value unless you prove the peculiar value to the
individual. Or then I have some personal value that's to the, you know, to the homeowner. So the Mosteller case was rental property, so that's different. Huber was dealing with trees on a person's property. It seems to me from reading these two cases that either one of these theories of damages may be used as long as one of them isn't misused. Like you can't use restoration value if it's going to exceed the actual value of the land. That would be unreasonable. But otherwise, it seems to me from reading the cases that restoration value is a valid rule of damages when a person's peaceful enjoyment of his property has been disturbed by a trespasser. No?
No, Your Honor, respectfully, because again, you're talking about a specific type of element that becomes part of the parcel itself. And the Mosteller case discussed Huber and explained why there's a dichotomy and the reasons for that. And I discussed earlier one of those is that it's
so
not
let me give you this example. Just your property, you put up a bunch of birch trees, beautiful birch trees that seclude your piece of property. You sit on your porch, you enjoy the beauty of the trees every day, so does your family. Your next door neighbor comes onto your property, cuts it all down. Okay? Nothing's left, no privacy, no enjoyment. Let's say the value of your property overall isn't diminished. Your position is that the homeowner who loses all of those birch trees is not entitled to any restoration of what was lost?
Not restoration damages, it's diminution of value. But even the cases that talk about restoration, they have a maximum recovery under the Volpe case cites to Professor Dodd that's limited up to the diminution in value. So that's one remedy.
So you're
that's
telling
available.
Me if the realty, overall realty, for whatever reason, isn't less than it was, the homeowner who loses all of his birch trees, all of his privacy, all of his shade, is entitled to nothing under your theory.
Unless, Your Honor, he establishes or she establishes that there's a peculiar value to them.
Well,
and the cases don't, the case law does not indicate, and Mosteller disagreed with it, and the Appellate Division here disagreed, that a generalized privacy claim is not sufficient to meet the peculiar value test. Now, for example, this is not what Your Honor suggested. It's not that they came in, they put in the birch trees, they put them in for a particular reason, they put them in to become a barrier, they put them in to be a fence, they put them in because the land is so open it needs shade. We have a peculiar reason for doing this. Their testimony is, we didn't touch it, we didn't do it, we didn't put it in for whatever that's worth. That's what they say. It's just on our property and we like it. This is not a situation where, similar, you don't have the benefit of the trial judge's opinion on the summary judgment motion, but she talked about the Huber case. The Huber property was a unique property. It was 14 and a half acres of property. It had one section of it. It had a building. It had a pasture. One small section of 2.5 to 3 acres. That section had 75 to 80-year-old trees, and it was used for, as the trial judge equated it, like a park. It was used for recreation and for their personal enjoyment in light of the other areas. So that's where the trial judge here saw Huber. It was a peculiar use to that family.
So let me read to you a line from Huber.
Yes.
Sound principle and persuasive authority support the allowance to an aggrieved landowner of the fair cost of restoring his land to a reasonable approximation of its former condition without necessary limitation to the diminution in the market value of the land, where a trespasser has destroyed shade or ornamental trees or shrubbery having peculiar value to the owner.
I agree, and it's peculiar value to the owner, and that's what the issue here is, Your Honor. Respectfully, I think that if you're simply arguing with generalized
privacy, what would peculiar mean other than a person who lives on the premises enjoying the beauty of the trees, the shade of the trees, the privacy provided by the trees? What could peculiar mean other than that, personal?
Well, the Mosteller Court is the one that indicated that those are the ordinary expectations for someone. If they lose the shade or they lose the privacy, those are the ordinary expectations. They don't become the peculiar value to an individual. So if you're dealing with that, you need something more than simply saying, I had privacy, I had shade, I had trees on my property. You need something more. The recreational nature of the specific types of trees that were 80 years old in Huber distinguishes that from the Mosteller case. Not so much that it was a rental property, because the court even said in the Mosteller case that it wasn't distinguishing it simply because it was a rental property.
Respectfully, I think you're reading Mosteller rather narrowly and in conjunction with Huber. It doesn't seem to fit with the way the restatement talks about people coming onto someone else's land and doing some destructive act. Specifically, the restatement section of 929, harm to land from past invasions. When there is, that section seems to talk about the fact that there can be restoration value as long as it doesn't greatly exceed the cost of the diminution in value, that there's not such a gross disparity between the two. And I don't read Musteller as suggesting that you have to have a diminution in value in order to have the option of choosing restoration cost as your damages in such an invasion of privacy.
Musteller does not say you have to have diminution in order to have that. It says that you have to have peculiar value in order to have a restoration as a valuation. That's my understanding.
Musteller also says in that case there is no evidence of clearing trees involving that was done with venial intent. Okay, let's assume that was so here. Nor is there evidence that defendant knew the trees were on plaintiff's property. I'm not sure that's so true here. So we know that this was an intentional act. And under the restatement, when there's an intentional destruction of including shrubbery or trees on another's property, that can get you restoration value.
Well, there's two things. First, there isn't any evidence of venial intent. I wanted the court to understand.
I'm leaving that aside.
But the landscaper is the one who took this, not my clients, off their property. There was a miscommunication, according to Dr. Westover. But going to your point, if there is an intentional act, I submit that there shouldn't be any really distinction between that. Trespass is trespass. It's going on one's property. If that could be handled by way, if there's a punitive allegation, there's a punitive allegation, as there is in this case.
Well, there's also the notion of nominal damages that Justice Timpone mentioned, and the
sure.
question is whether plaintiffs are entitled to more than that.
I understand, Your Honor. But I want to go back to your reference to the restatement, since you brought that up. I don't know that it was in the papers, but I would direct Your Honor to the comment B of the restatement. And that's in that, essentially, it says, if the cost of replacing the land in its original condition is disproportionate to the diminution in the value of the land caused by the trespass, unless there is a reason personal to the owner for restoring the original condition, damages are measured only by the difference between the value of the land before and after the harm. I think that's what our law is. Our law is.
So your argument is because there's no evidence of diminution in value in this record, the court is prohibited from considering the restoration cost to replant that bamboo trees? Is that your position?
Because there's no evidence of a peculiar value, the plaintiff can only prove their case by establishing diminution in value.
Does the restatement use the term peculiar?
It says personal.
So let's take, we're the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Okay, so we have appellate division cases, and we're going to be deciding the rule and what language should govern. Why not that restatement language? I'm not certain what peculiar means. I think personal, I do understand. A person who enjoys the beauty of the trees, the shade of the trees, the privacy provided by the trees. Like, why, as a basic element of fairness, if one neighbor goes onto another neighbor's property and destroys those trees,
right,
why shouldn't they be restored, provided that the restoration isn't so dramatically unreasonable given the value of the property?
Because of the difficulty in establishing what would be reasonable on an item that is not a commodity. And that's why the case law indicates.
You plant new trees. Maybe they can't be 100 feet, but you have to make some effort to restore what was taken from the aggrieved party.
I understand, Your Honor. But as the case law reads, and as Huber, and when you analyze them along with Musteller, if you have a peculiar value, or if Your Honor, if the court decides to use personal value under the restatement, that's certainly its prerogative. But there has to be something that is peculiar, unusual. If it becomes personal, any plaintiff comes in and says, I liked them because they were tall. I liked them because they were short. I liked them because they were birch. I liked them because they gave me shade.
What's wrong with that?
Well,
if it's on your property and you own them,
what's
wrong? I lost all my trees. I want them restored. Is there something crazy about that?
Well, no, Your Honor, but it has to be within the realm of reasonableness. And that's why the case law, even in trespass, talks about it, and Dodds talks about it, that puts a limitation, even on restoration, when it's even available, up to the diminution in the market value. So that if you're on, if the court has indicated, for example, a perfect example of that would be a car accident when you have property damage. If you go to restore the car and happen to be a Mercedes and it's $15,000 to restore the car, but its value was $5,000, there's a maximum. And they pay the car and it's totaled and they move on. There's nothing different in that respect. So the plaintiff shouldn't be given the option. Certainly if you're on, if the court chooses to call it personal and allow restoration, there should be a maximum up to the diminution of the value. Very similar to that situation.
But why isn't it the cost of replacing the trees rather than a diminution in value?
Because, Your Honor, a perfect example of that is both Huber and Mosteller. The plaintiff presented evidence in Huber in 1959 that the value of each tree, the 50 trees, was $2,100 because they were grown 75-year-old trees, and to bring them in would cost over $100,000. You're talking about a property that they had just purchased for $20,000 to $21,000. Mosteller, six trees were taken. The estimate was $439,000. The property had just been purchased recently for $440,000. So what happens is that restoration of mature to the same position becomes so unreasonable and so difficult to calculate and so difficult to do that it's not a reasonable assessment of the
right,
value.
Right, but you don't get nothing. In Huber, it's interesting. It all went to the jury, and the jury determined the reasonable restoration value. Okay, maybe they couldn't recreate the 100-foot tree, but it was reasonable, and they gave $20,000. That went to the jury.
They gave, in Huber, it was $6,500, but you're correct.
Okay.
The jury gave $6,500 based upon expert testimony as to the value of the shade, the value of the tree itself, and a couple incidental repairs.
But we didn't get that far because the court granted summary judgment.
Right. We didn't get that far because the plaintiff made no effort to do anything other than put in an expert report that originally said $16,000 for replacement, not only of the bamboo, but also to put in other trees that were irrelevant. And then they said, well, you know what, more time has passed. We want to remove some of the bamboo that's there. We want to put in a barrier, and we want to put in other ornamental trees. We want to create privacy. Well, that's not restoring, and that's the $41,000 assessment that's in the record. So that's not what they were trying to do in this case. What they were trying to do is exactly what happened in Huber and exactly what happened in Mosteller with the plaintiff's proofs, which was to create a value that was unreasonable. In this particular case, the plaintiff had the opportunity, just didn't take it, to seek a diminution of value. It's not like we have a record here that...
But these arguments that you're making are arguments that sound like they should have been presented to the jury, not used as a disqualifier to even allow the case to proceed.
Well, Your Honor, what the trial judge did in this case was...
They said that there was no valid evidence or proof on damages because of the failure to produce something on diminution in value.
Correct. And that was the appropriate remedy, and the plaintiff didn't provide an expert.
Well, that's the question here, whether or not legally that evidence must be put forward in order for restoration to even be considered by the jury. That's the legal question that we're grappling
with. Well, I understand, Your Honor. If that is the case, the answer should be yes, because there should still be a comparison between the if the court allows it, there still should be a comparison between the diminution in market value and the restoration cost, and it should be the lesser of the two. It shouldn't be an amount in excess of that.
Well, you can do that. Well, do you know the value of the Kornblut's home?
At the time, I don't.
He's saying $20,000 to $25,000. Now, I don't know. A jury may find that's unreasonable. You get 10 or 15. Isn't that a jury issue?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. That's not in the record that's the diminution in value.
No. That's the restoration value.
Correct. But he's also presented no evidence that there's a change in any way of the market value or that the market value was higher, minimal, or the same. Mm-hmm. See, you cannot compare it and you cannot assess the maximum reasonable assessment of the value if you don't have some evaluation of the diminution in the market value, because you certainly can't have what we have here, which is a plaintiff simply coming in and seeking to prove one thing. I want to restore it, and I want to restore it with items other than just the bamboo, and these are my costs, and this is what I want to do.
I don't see what's so wrong about that, and quite frankly, I don't read either Mosteller or Huber is suggesting otherwise.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, when the Huber Court looked at the restoration costs assessed by the plaintiff, when they said $2,100 per tree at 50 trees, they said that's unreasonable. It shouldn't even be gone. It shouldn't even have gone to the jury. And in the Mosteller case, the court also said that the replacement of three trees,
it's unreasonable compared to the overall cost of the property. If you don't have that, you can't make a comparison. Is that what you're saying?
If you don't have the overall
value. In order to determine reasonableness, you have to determine, for example, if a property is worth $8,000, $100,000 to replace a tree is not reasonable. But if the property is worth millions, $20,000 may be more than reasonable, maybe on the low end. But without the comparison, you can't do the analysis. Is that what you're saying?
I am, Your Honor. It's also saying you need evaluation of what the property is and what the diminution is in order to decide. There has to be an evaluation as to the value of the property to determine whether or not there's a reasonable assessment, a restoration cost, if that's allowed. Secondly, it should only be limited to the difference, or the lesser of the two, diminution of value or the restoration cost. And that's why you have to have both in that situation.
In Mosteller, the true value of the trees exceeded the value of the property. Are you suggesting that this $20,000 to $25,000 figure is any way approximating the value of the Kornbluth's property?
No, I'm not.
Your argument is diminution in value, and as far as we know, the diminution in value is zero. And since we don't have that value, we can't compare the two, and therefore summary judgment was proper.
That's correct. And what happened here is the judge found that the primary measure of damages was not established. And that's why, under the circumstances, she found that peculiar value had not been established when you say privacy. And the case law throughout the country, even addressing that issue, deals with what is a peculiar value. And it doesn't include simply privacy. There's always something additional to that. It's not simply beauty. And Mosteller was very similar to this case, because two of the four arguments raised by the plaintiff in that case was, it's not as private, and the property is not as attractive. That's just another way of saying that it's not. We have a privacy here. We have privacy in our property, and we miss the beauty. They're the same thing. It's just semantics. And both Mosteller and the Appellate Division found that under Mosteller, you hadn't, and Huber, they hadn't proven peculiar value to them, and that's why the court chose the remedy. And Your Honor, and I want to direct the court to this, even this court has stated that in the context of, I have to find it in my case, excuse me one moment, in the context of even the trespass law, this court has said you don't mechanically apply, even where it's applicable, the restoration cost test. And that was in 525 Main Street Corp. at 34 NJ 251-255. And it says that even the restoration cost is not mechanically applied. So it's not as plaintiff would ask this court to decide. It's not simply you get either or, and I want to prove one and I want to prove the other. That's a mechanical application.
Could you give us the site for that again?
Yes. It is 525 Main Street Corp. versus Eagle Roofing Company, 34 NJ 251-255, 1961, and it's cited in the Mosteller case at page 640, Your Honor. That's right.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
Nothing, Your Honor. Thank you.
Yes, please come to the center.
Thank you. With respect to the review below, page 5 of the Appellate Division's decision, and that's the official e-court's file decision, page 5, second paragraph, states clearly that there will be a review on all the issues, notwithstanding what could be procedural issues. There's a full review on the issues, and there's a full transcript. And the appendix that's been filed with this court shows that there was a totally and full record with respect to all these issues that were submitted below, and the court said it addressed it. Secondly, I think certainly the colloquy with Justices Lavecchia and Alvin and other justices in supporting questions that certainly grasped the issue. I would point that number, and helpfully, in the Mosteller decision, on what looks like page 641, I'm reading from a Westlaw a secondary source, but it looks like 641 of the original citation. The court says, very important, it gives identification to what the words peculiar value means, because the court says, quote, we concur with the motion judge that the assorted items of damage, including loss of shade, the increased erosion of risk, and so, did not rise to the level of special harm. So there we have amplification in the Mostower decision of what, in fact, substantively is meant by peculiar value. But that's what intuitively we certainly understand that means. Secondly, to the extent that there's any issue about the comparisons between diminution of value, that's a matter of defense if it's not raised certainly by the plaintiff. Plaintiff certainly has a right to choose a remedy that they think is supported by the law. If in fact there's to be a defense of that, then the defense has to be raised. There was no defense. That was argument made below, no motions, and certainly no record, and no substance to the absence of that. And as Justice Albin pointed out, there could be any question with the $25,000 asserted cost of that time, at the time of the trial, that there was, that was what the cost at that time was of the remediation. There's no question here about any disproportionate relationship between that and the its value. Thank you. Appreciate you.
Thank you to counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in recess for a half hour.